You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Kali Akuno of Cooperation Jackson about a new collaborative endeavor called Ungovernable, which builds resilient communities and organized resistance to the policies of hate, discrimination, and destruction.
We have a major challenge on our hands. And we know that they're going to pass laws discriminating against women. They're going to pass laws targeting immigrants. They're going to give more power to the police to hunt people and to target black people and to target other, quote unquote, undesirable communities and populations. And if we acquiesce and if we accept this, then we wind up not only legitimating it, but giving it power.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Agwanu, welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land in Bunawabskig Territory, home of the Penobscot Nation, where we are awaiting a covering of ice tomorrow. Rumor has it that the whole area is going to be covered in ice tomorrow. So everyone is feverishly running to the grocery store to get the last loaf of bread and the last gallon of milk before the ice apocalypse hits us here in the state of Maine. And I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Mr. Rivera Sun, and we have got an incredible show on tap for you today. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's good to hear from you, and I bet an ice storm in your area means lots of good writing time for you and less traveling on the road, which I'm glad about because I'm looking forward to more of your writing coming up in 2017. You are right about this being a really interesting show. I've been keeping my eyes open for the most strategic responses to the times that we're in, and lo and behold, surprise, surprise, one of our former guests, Kali Akuno from Cooperation Jackson, popped up on my radar with a project that he is the co-instigator of and a participant in called Ungovernable. It is a movement that's emerging for building resistant and resilient strategies for stopping hate, racism, oppression, and the myriad of problems that we are facing in this new era that we have entered into. So, Kali, welcome to today's show, and thank you for taking the time to have this conversation with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Kali, I'm excited about this conversation because I think that on the flip side of being ungovernable is really a demonstration of what democracy looks like, where there is this inability to control the people who are part of a society. And really what ungovernable is about having a population of people be unwilling to be controlled by those who hold positions of power and lord that power over them in unhealthy and destructive ways. So let's jump right in and let's tell our listeners, what does it mean to be ungovernable and what is that going to look like for us going forward?
Well, thank you for the question. Again, thank you for inviting me on and for covering, I think, this timely and important topic. So just jumping right in, the first thing it means is not complying with the arbitrary rules and processes and procedures that the Trump regime and the neo-Confederate Republicans are going to be setting in place all throughout this country. you know, we are not just focusing in on Trump, even though that's bad enough, but there is now, you know, a Republican and very reactionary Supreme Court on its way. It's not fully in place yet, as we know, but, with Trump in place and Republican-controlled House and Senate, they will basically get what they want, and you can best believe it's not going to be something that's going to serve or someone who's not going to serve the interests of the vast majority of people who live within the United States. Number two, you know, we have this Tea Party / neo-Confederate legislature, which is just as bad, just as dangerous as Trump, probably not as bombastic, but more strategic, I think, in the surgical precision of the rights that they want to take away and what they want to restrict. And then you have the state governorships. I think it's now, 28 of the 50 are in Republican hands, and 33 of the 50 states are controlled by these Republican-dominated legislatures. So we have a major challenge on our hands, and we know that they're going to pass laws discriminating against women. They're going to pass laws targeting immigrants. They're going to beef up already in state after state on a federal level, give more power to the police to hunt people and to target Black people and to target other quote-unquote undesirable communities and populations. And if we acquiesce and if we accept this, then we wind up not only legitimating it, but giving it power. So being ungovernable starts there. Do not give any of this power. Do not give any of it legitimacy. And you can resist on a number of different ways. It shouldn't look all the same because we're not all in the same positionality to resist. But in whatever way that you can, you know, if it's speaking out, if it's organizing protests and demonstrations, if it's stopping and disrupting commerce, all those different kind of tactics and ways of expressing your, you know, refusal to go along with this new program, this new dictates, are all what we would consider parts of ungovernable, just as a, at a basic level. On a deeper level, it really requires a deeper and more profound and radical level of organizing within our society. And that is what we're ultimately trying to encourage. Because we don't, in defeating kind of Trump and the neo-Confederates, we don't just want to go back to the status quo. I mean, we want to make that very clear. The status quo, be that, you know, the 8 years under Obama or the 8 years under Bush or Clinton and almost all of them, you know, before, was never inclusive of everybody, was never intended to be inclusive of everybody. And so we need something more. We need something better. And I think as more people are becoming, I think, politicized and awoken about, you know, the contradictions of our society and the system that we live in and desiring real change. And I think prepared to act to bring that about in a more determined manner. I think we definitely have to push for a new society, one that is actually democratic, because we don't live in a democratic society now, which is part of the problem of how we got to the situation we're now currently facing. So those are the kind of the long-term aims, you know. So there's the short-term, you know, tactical, and then there's the long-term strategic of really setting ourselves on a course to create what we need for the future.
One of the things that intrigued me about the platform that you've set up for Ungovernable is really, as Sherry was starting to say, that it's rooted in self-governance of self and community, that if we look at the, I don't know if there's 12 or more strategic points of Ungovernable, they're all framed in terms of build, 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 build. Of course, there's one mm-hmm. part that's the build and one part that's called the fight. But even the fight is termed in words of build this, build that, build this. Mm-hmm. Would you speak a little bit about those points, particularly what's very interesting to me and goes a bit deeper than a lot of the protest movements that we've seen recently is the building of food sovereignty systems, energy sovereignty systems, production and supply systems, cooperatives. And then the last point on the build section is people's assembly and actual democracy, the very processes of self-governance that allow us to have the collective framework for resisting the governance of an oppressive and unjust regime. So if you could speak mm-hmm. a little bit more about those, I would definitely appreciate it, and I know our listeners will be intrigued.
Mm-hmm. Well, we ultimately, I think, you know, and I'm speaking in a broad sense that beyond just this ungovernable project, I think we, if given a choice, people want to live in a just world. And given the parameters, and if we can create the structures, I think most people would choose to not only engage, but I think participate actively and constructively in building it. So from our vantage point and really articulating that program, we wanted to kind of put that out and really draw on the deep aspirations of people for a new world and for democracy. I think even those folks who, you know, voted for Trump, they really want something different. They were tired of the same old, same old. And I think they took a gamble. It's a somewhat unfortunate gamble. But given the limited choices that the system produced, we are what we are. And so what this piece is really trying to articulate is, how do we lay the firm foundation on the ground in our communities for something different? And how do we set up programs that we can begin to execute on a community level ourselves with the limited resources that exist in most communities? And if you live in a community like mine, where there's, you know, just tons of abandoned buildings and empty houses, but there's also a ton of people who have a lot of time because they're either underemployed or unemployed or just structurally excluded from work at this point. You know, but they have time, they have energy, they have a vision. And if we can put people together, organize people, rally people, build a common, you know, vision and a common set of practices with people, we can begin to institute certain levels and degrees of creating food sovereignty, and I think in a lot of our communities. We can definitely organize cooperatives almost any and every place that we can. A lot of our communities have both formal and informal types of cooperatives already. These are things that we can practically do that can radically transform the quality of life wherever we are at. And that was a program that we really wanted to put forth as a positive program. And so it's not just, you know, we're going to survive this and overcome it because, you know, we can stop traffic this day, or, you know, we can stop this meeting that day. That's not often always possible for everyday people to kind of participate in. And sometimes, you know, the act can be, those types of acts can actually be very disempowering because they don't often tend to lead to kind of immediate rewards. And we have to really, I think, articulate, you know, what is going to change the society, what is going to change us, you know, just as importantly, to create what we want to see, to create, you know, in a prefigurative way, you know, what we're aiming for and what we're hoping to achieve. So that is a core component of what the build and fight is. You know, it's really trying to articulate a basic vision of a different alternative kind of future. But it starts with things that we believe are somewhat practical and with people's grasps that don't require tremendous amount of resourcing from external forces, but can draw deep from within communities to pull out the resources that oftentimes we don't even know exist or we kind of overlook. And how do we do that? I mean, that is really a kind of a short list of some things that we wanted to put out there and frame. Now, that doesn't mean these things are easy. Let me qualify that. Starting a co-op is not easy. You know, learning to share your time, energy, and resources with others is not easy, particularly in the way we've been socialized in this society. So it's going to require some work. There's no way really to kind of get around that. But that's why we framed it as build. And in the practice, as a good friend of mine has articulated, in the practice, be willing to be transformed by the work. So that is a part of the long-term vision, the things that you outlined, you know, from the People's Assembly to the co-ops to, you know, the food sovereignty. All that is part of really trying to convince a broader audience of, you know, how we can take things in our own hands and begin transforming our communities and society.
Kali, I think that this really is lighting up some receptors for me. I just have finished writing a section on my book on childlike dependence, that we have been living in a paternalistic society no matter where we come from for thousands of years. And we have this childlike dependence on the ruling class to and obedience to the ruling class, whether we come from the largest city in America or a rural village in India. We have all been living under this form of paternalistic rule, which creates this guardian ward relationship where those in power make decisions that override, restrict, and interfere with our daily freedoms. And so when I look at that and I look at where we are right now, the movement that is beginning is truly an evolution of our consciousness, where we are breaking out of this paternalistic, childlike dependence on those who have the ability, the moneyed interests, who have the ability to buy their way into power within our systems, where we are finally growing up, taking off this cloak of dependence that we have been living under for thousands of years, and beginning to take responsibility for shaping the communities in which we live, the societies in which we live. You know, and so when we start looking at the work required to undo all of that conditioning, centuries of conditioning, millennia of conditioning towards paternalistic rule, there are a lot of things that we're going to have to unravel within our own minds as we engage that process. Have you run into issues that you can link to this idea of dependency, where we are requiring and demanding that someone else solve our problems, and how that may be something that we're going to have to work through to recognize that we are the ones that are going to be responsible for solving our problems? Because what we're really doing as a society is we're growing up.
Excellent question. We run in Cooperation Jackson, we run into those problems every day, all the time. And one of our kind of mantras, you know, is that it's harder working for yourself than working for someone else. And where does that come from? For us, you know, it's just trying to walk, you know, all our members, particularly a lot of the younger members, in understanding all of the details that it really takes to build, you know, the cooperatives. And how much often, you know, all of us take certain things for granted, that they're just going to be there, or they'll be accessible at our fingertips or at our beck and call, and how much others, people's kind of labor that we often don't see and we don't recognize, we don't appreciate, but how we're really dependent upon that, both in positive and negative ways, right? But, I think this part where you mentioned about the growing up really appeals to me, because, you know, even for myself, having started a cooperative before, really taking on this project over the last couple of years, for me and my own consciousness, there's been, a tremendous amount of kind of waking up of, you know, what in particular some of the younger generations just don't have and haven't been socialized with in terms of both information, but our skills and processes, both social and technical. And then just unlearning, as you spoke to, the conditioning. My conditioning as a heterosexual cis male, and the different ways that impacts on, you know, me being a democratic collaborator and partner, ally and comrade, even with the best of intentions, certain things that I've been socialized with, they get in the way. You know, they're stumbling blocks. They wind up being obstacles, and it may not be the intent. It's often not in my intent. But there are ways, I think, you know, be fortunate enough to have built at least a camaraderie where aspects of it can be challenged, called out, and we can come up with some collective solutions on how to move some things forward. But this is part of what I was speaking to about learning democracy and learning how to be democratic. And the more time, you know, I've spent, in particularly in terms of trying to build Cooperation Jackson, you know, the more I learned just how undemocratic a world we live in. And what is at the root of that? I think those are some things that are really worth investigating and struggling with, that are really scourges in a lot of sense on our social movements, you know, and how these things are embedded in ourselves and in our movements and in our organizations, and what type of work, you know, to not only transform the external world, but transform ourselves. The kind of growing up that you mentioned, too, I think is a necessary part. And the thing about this generation is bringing that level of focus and attention, I think, to the movement, I think, is a healthy thing. You know, there are some parts of it I would still think argue kind of go a bit too far and push people away rather than bring them in still. But I think I understand the intent on trying to make sure we get it right and try to make sure that when people engage each other, they help each other become whole and not drain each other or exploit and harm each other. So that this is becoming more and more, I think, a part of our tradition I think is leading us to make not just the surface kind of transformations, but the deeper transformations that I think are going to be needed for us to, I think, really withstand the challenges that are coming. I don't think we fully, unfortunately, have faced the worst yet with Trump. I think that there's more on a systemic level that there's going to have to be content with some things that, you know, our species has put in motion, particularly around climate and the ecology, that we're going to have to come to grips with. And I think really work to try to make better and correct for future generations so that there is actually something that people can survive upon, that we are the current generations leave for the future. And that becomes, you know, for me, more and more imperative every day. I have two young children who are, you know, who I'm learning with. And I want to see them have the same level, if not more, of the resources that I had at my disposal, also which were taken for granted. What do I mean by that? I'm a science, you know, nerd and all that kind of stuff, and pretty much always have been. But it really pains me almost every week with the things that I keep up with, you know, that giraffes might be extinct soon. Elephants might be extinct soon. Rhinos are almost extinct. Almost every species of rhino now. Polar bears. And to think that, you know, these are things that I didn't often see because I didn't live in the places where their natural habitat was. But, you know, I knew it was there. And I knew that there was some opportunity. And I remember as a child just being kind of thankful that's there. But you kind of take it for granted that it's always going to be there and they'll be able to enjoy living on a planet where these other complex species are there, living in harmony with us. And we are the force that's restricting that life and choking and killing it. And that is part of, I think, this immaturity of this paternalistic system that you were speaking about. You know, it doesn't just have an impact on humanity. It's had an impact on the planet. And the planet ultimately will be fine without us. But I would like to see us kind of fulfill the potentiality of the human species, which I think we've barely only begun to tap into. And I'd like to see a world where my children have the option of being able to keep striving for that. And I would want that for all the children, you know, in the world. So that's a driving piece to me. And I think it's part of millions of others who are also kind of coming to this consciousness and this awakening. And I think we just have to work on organizing it so it's in a form that we can work on it together to have more impact on society, you know, in the future. And I think we have the capacity to do it. I really do finally believe that.
There's a famous quote, which I'm not going to quote exactly, but it's the idea that the greatest threat to humanity's survival is the belief that someone else will save us. And if there is one silver lining to the Trump presidency and administration and the cabinet choices, which horror story author Stephen King termed the motley crew of plunder monkeys.
I like that.
That's why we need to support the arts and writing in this country, is because you have someone mm-hmm. like Stephen King, who knows a horror story when he sees it, come up with a line like that. But one of the things about this presidency and all that comes with it, as you mentioned, it's way beyond Trump. And it's actually just that Trump is the tip of the iceberg of a belief system that has been allowed to flourish for far too long in this country. Mm-hmm. But if we have one silver lining, it's that a lot of us have figured out finally, at last, that nothing in that system is going to save us. And with all previous administrations, a lot of people were still hung up on the myth, even with some of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side this time. Hillary Clinton was giving people the belief that she might just save them, which many of us were skeptical about. Her climate plan certainly wasn't going to save us. Bernie Sanders, although he was a far better choice in a lot of directions than any of the other candidates, still carried with him, because of the weight of the system we're confronting, the belief that he might just save us. But now we're left without that belief, and now we're left with this question that I think you're really doing a really interesting job of addressing with ungovernable, this idea that we are not going to be saved by anyone but ourselves. So what are the steps that we need to take?
Right.
To make sure that we are doing the work that is required for caring for our communities, ourselves, and each other. Now, I want to ask some questions about how this movement is growing. You put out the idea, or you and your co-instigators put out the idea before the holiday season, I believe. I could be wrong about that. And then you planned for a J20 Inauguration Day launch, and you had a series of actions and rallies and events and demonstrations around the country this weekend, or the inauguration weekend. Will you speak more about those and about what's coming next after this round?
Well, let me back up just a tad there. So we did put it out before the kind of the holiday break. So that is correct. And early this month, we made some strategic decisions to not overly focus on the 20th or the 21st, because there were so many calls. You know, I think at one point I had assembled close to 51 different kind of national appeals and national calls for action, either on the 20th or the 21st, you know, from different organizations, from different coalitions. And I was just like, wow, okay, you know, there's a lot. And there's a beauty in that, but there's also something distressing about that. The beauty is that so many people were getting emotion. The distressing thing was how few of us were actually talking to each other and kind of doing overlapping things in the same city, in the same area. And sometimes you have to do that. In the here and now, sometimes the differences between some of the organizations is too great to try to really do justice to the message that each is trying to send. So I understand that. But in a moment like this, you know, it really just kind of spoke to us still being stuck in some of our old ways, old sectarian ways. And that really kind of caught us. And for us to then kind of recognize that on a certain level, we are, you know, being 52, we're playing into some of this dynamic and some of this kind of social game, if you would, ourselves. So how can we be proactive and try to step out of that and step back? So without having totally figured it out, one of the things that we collectively said was, let's begin to try to encourage folks to connect with the different activities that are already in motion in their cities, and to get people to do a radical thing. Let's get people to talk to each other. You know, not on Facebook, not on Twitter, not on text message, but like, you know, get people to come together and talk to each other. So we started putting less emphasis in our kind of communication with folks organizing and coordinating kind of demonstrations. I think we could have and should have done even more, just as a point of self-criticism in that area. But I think we touched on to something that I think is right, which was trying to pivot within the last kind of week and a half of saying, in particular, saying, focus on a demonstration, but if you can, bring people together for conversations afterwards and have a conversation about, you know, what ungovernable means to you and what it might look like to you in your community. And that there are some ideas which we put in our framework that people can either choose or not choose to use as a starting point. But we just felt the most important piece was bringing people together to start having some dialogue in terms of kind of building some alignment. So that is something that for us, we are going to continue to push for the next, you know, month, if not until beyond, you know, and to really push ungovernable as a broad collective framework that we are co-constructing with each other. And that, you know, the co-conspirators, as you mentioned, you know, we have some ideas. We feel very passionate about the piece and the vision that we put out. But we know it's incomplete. It's not a whole. It's not a finished product. You know, there's still a lot that we all can learn and have to learn. But we want to at least take the step of encouraging people, despite their organization, despite their affiliation, despite their political views, to begin having a dialogue on how do we build a really effective, broad base and deep, you know, ungovernable program that we can all engage in that is addressing all of our collective needs.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. This week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to explore the twofold strategy of oppose and propose that underlies effective organizing for nonviolent change. When we oppose a problem, policy, or practice in our world, we have many options for organizing resistance. We can mobilize to withdraw cooperation and participation from the unjust system, whether that be our own or that of another group involved in causing or supporting the injustice. We can use acts of protest and persuasion to raise awareness, challenge falsehoods, and reveal truth. In so doing, we have an opportunity to open dialogues towards change, rally supporters, change hearts and minds, and, hopefully, the objectionable practices and policies. On top of these two modes of resistance, we can also use acts of nonviolent intervention to get in the way of the harmful behavior. We can block access to needed supplies, overload systems, disrupt functionality, and much more, all using nonviolent tactics. Additionally, acts of intervention can be used to disrupt the complacency of bystanders and the ancillary groups involved in the conflict situation. On the proposed side of the equation, we can generate solutions, policy changes, new practices, and also build new, alternative, and parallel systems and structures. These constructive programs, as Gandhi called them, build resilience in our movements, increase self-reliance, and lessen dependency on oppressive forces and unjust institutions, policies, and practices. They give our movements the autonomy and resources to withdraw consent, and to sustain campaigns of nonviolent intervention. Additionally, building new systems, proposing solutions, and creating alternative institutions can engage a broad range of people in a form of making change that can sometimes be more creative and less physically risky for the participants. Together, these strategies can lead to powerful movements. They stop injustice in its tracks, withdraw support from the old practices, and engage society and participation in a new system or solution. In the subject of today's show, we see these dynamics at work in Ungovernable. The project calls for building community farms and food distribution centers to address basic subsistence needs of the people. Also, they call for building production and supply chain networks and alliances to ensure food security and sovereignty on municipal and larger scales. They ask people to work on building community energy networks and centers to address basic energy needs, to build and reclaim common spaces, to form cooperatives of workers, consumers, and/or community. They ask people to build people's assemblies or other types of vehicles for the practice of participatory democracy to continue the struggle for equality and equity. They also call for strategies of opposition and resistance, including joining and building sanctuary networks to defend immigrants, Muslims, organizers, and the persecuted. They ask people to consider making autonomous communication and information sharing institutions to ensure safe and direct connection amongst people. One of their points is to build defense committees and to launch educational campaigns. They call for people to make broad civil action units to engage massive civil disobedience, occupation, and general strike actions to stop the advance of political and economic oppression. This outline of a twofold strategy offers a sense of how we can engage the oppose and propose dynamics in our own communities, movements, and campaigns. In so doing, we can work to create successful efforts for change. So, listeners, perhaps you can look around at the work you're doing, and maybe you'll see some ways to balance these two powerful aspects of making change. How would you play if you knew it all ended tomorrow? Now, let's return to our program.
So we are going to be putting out a series of calls to try to have some national calls, but more importantly, trying to stimulate and encourage people in all of their communities. If it's on your block or if it's throughout your entire city, start having some dialogue there about what it means to be ungovernable, what it means to start creating the future that we want to see now, and how to do both in a way that effectively, you know, resists the reaction that's being or attempted to be forced down our throats and move beyond in a way that we can both overcome that, but move beyond it and see this as an opportunity for broader transformation. So community meetings is the first priority. And we're going to support, you know, a lot of the other, continue to support a lot of the calls, you know, that people are putting out, from the movement of Black Lives to everything we've seen from Right to the City and Grassroots Global Justice Alliance and the Climate Justice Alliance, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and a bunch of, I can just go on, you know, folks are calling for kind of 100 days of action. And we're going to continue, we're going to promote that very broadly and encourage folks to engage. But I think our particular piece that we're going to focus in on now, it's really kind of trying to create some tools and some processes that really get people oriented on that build side and to facilitate, you know, how do you begin to have kind of conversations about, you know, how to move from like our community gardens to food sovereignty? How do we scale up in our communities? How do we really build sanctuary cities? What does that all entail? What are the risks involved? How do we organize ourselves to make sure that, you know, there are the legal funds there? Is the legal support, you know, that might be necessary for that type of engagement, and getting people prepared for, you know, the level of repression that is more likely going to come down, and build the kind of solidarity that will be needed for folks to withstand that type of pressure and that type of assault, so people don't feel alone, they don't feel isolated, and are within their, you know, working from their sense of inner strength and inner power to be able to stand up, speak out, and to take action. So those are the things that I think we're really going to focus on over the course of the next couple of weeks and months, is that's a glue that we kind of see missing, that we think, you know, this connective tissue needs to be built, and we're going to try to play a role to facilitate that.
I think it's really important to have people talking with one another and coming together, because when we look at the pledge, the second piece of the pledge is to make sure that the administration is unable to deceive the people. And so when we have things happening like this newly coined phrase by Kellyanne Conway, alternative facts, where there is a suggestion that, you know, an unverified report that is disputed by the eyes of people on the ground is an alternative fact, and where there is a concerted effort to prove that alternative fact is real, to the point where you have Merriam-Webster stepping in and making a point of saying a fact is generally understood to refer to something with actual existence. And so the spin is going to get pretty fast and furious, I think. And in order for us to be able to get our bearings under the weight of that spin, we're going to need to be having real conversations in real time about the things mm-hmm. that are going on. That's going to be part of our responsibility, is to make sure that the people aren't deceived, which means that there needs to be someone showing up every single day that's reliable, eyewitnesses to all of the things that are happening. And so I think that's a really important piece, which corresponds to the need for us to come together and to engage one another as human beings and to renew, as you said, that connective thread, that connective tissue that exists between us, because we've become so isolated and separated in so many ways. And, you know, that too is part of our evolution of consciousness, the recognition that we are all connected, and to take tangible steps in the real world to make those connections more solidified, I think is vitally important. So I love that. One of the things that I want to talk about that came out of these marches for me was the great need for understanding intersectionality, for understanding mm-hmm. some of the promotion of traditionally white establishment voices in the movement. And we had a march here in the state capitol, and there were 8 speakers, and 6 of them were white women. There was one Black woman who was representing the immigrant community from Somalia, and one Native woman who spoke on behalf of the water and the protection of the earth. And when the organizers were approached to add another Native speaker, me, because of what some viewed as my ability to kind of unify the movement and synthesize some of these issues, the response was, but we already have a Native speaker. And so, you know, we have this tendency to allow white women within these movements to have a broad spectrum of ideas and to represent a broad spectrum of issues. However, people of color are limited to tokenism. And so we have work to do in regard to addressing those issues too, to recognize that there are people from all walks of life, from every different group, who have this embodiment of intersectionality within them. And if we fail to recognize that within our movements going forward, then we're going to just be promoting the same status quo image that we're trying to unravel. And so, you know, the importance of recognizing those pieces as we frame these movements going forward, I think is also part of that crucial underpinning of the work that needs to be done in order to avoid creating something that looks exactly like what we're trying to walk away from. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
That's a long conversation in and of itself. Unfortunately, a lot of reports that I've heard, your experience on Saturday was not alone. It was not isolated. That dynamic, unfortunately, sounds like was still kind of a dominant dynamic throughout the country. Now, even though I think that there was some very deliberate and intentional struggles, you know, from the beginning to make sure that race was seriously talked about, that there was an intersectional analysis that was included in the orientation and framing and building of the action on Saturday. Just having teach-ins, just having statements and frameworks doesn't mean that this centuries and millennia, as you know, rightfully pointed out, of socialization just goes away. And I'm not excusing that practice in any form or fashion. So I hope no one listens to me and gets that wrong. But, you know, I think it speaks to how much work we have to do, I think, to continue to struggle inside of our communities and inside of our movements to get people to understand their own positionality and where it is both a benefit and at times can be, I don't want to say a liability, but a constricting point for others to be able to engage if utilized in a way that does not allow people to have their full voice and to be fully present, and or for us to see the complexity of each and every human being and also deal with the complexity of our history, and particularly in this country, the sad history around, you know, genocide and enslavement, and the stealing of, you know, entire land mass, and where those always have to be front and central in our discussions. And I would say in our discussion about any and everything. Too often I've been in spaces where, you know, it's like, well, we'll bring that up after this, or that doesn't really touch upon this, or that's somehow excluded from that. When in reality, we can't have any conversation or any point of reference in this society without either of those two sad points of history and those atrocities having an impact on everything else that's going on. So for us, in terms of some practical things, you know, just in Mississippi, we bring it down to where, you know, it's practical. So we, here in Jackson, Jackson is 85% black. And you would think that living in a overwhelmingly black city, that you would not have to have a lot of conversations about white supremacy, when in fact the opposite is true, because so much of that has been internalized in our own community and in our own organizations. You know, that is drawn from a poem from Amir Baraka, that it's going to take hundreds of years for us to, you know, get out, as he put it, get out of kind of this mind frame and framework. You know, so it's a very real thing. So the ongoing education about, you know, both the positive and negatives about any and all culture, and how we have to struggle within our own culture around things which kind of reinforce white supremacy, or things within our own culture that reinforce, you know, patriarchy. There's some internal work that has to be done, and some things that have to be struggled through, and that our cultures are indeed permeable. They grow, they change, they're dynamic, they flex, they can adapt and adjust, and we just don't have to be stuck doing certain things because that's the way it's always been done, is a big struggle that we have here, particularly in our defense of queer and trans folks, where a lot of the things in our community, the Bible and Christianity served as a place of refuge, you know, during the period of enslavement and apartheid. But that also had some negative baggage that also came along with it, particularly as it related to how people understand and define relationships between, you know, men and women, quote unquote, and how they looked at gay, lesbian, queer, transsexual, intersexual folks, which is a big struggle internally inside our own community that we're waging and trying to support, and how we have to both be patient with folks who don't feel comfortable, quote unquote, in the presence of queer or trans folks, but also be able to push them and try to get them to see the deep humanity in themselves and in those who they're standing opposed to. You know, that's an ongoing piece, some of which we, in our practice, we say, you know, sometimes it's easier to act your way into new thinking than it is to think your way into new acting. And sometimes, I think in our case, just like use that as an example, you know, sometimes just being insistent that we're going to do personal pronouns in the beginning of each meeting, to where for us initially, when we introduced it about a year and a half ago, was vehemently resisted by certain sectors of our community and even our membership. Whereas now it's just kind of an accepted norm, us doing it. And there's still disagreement around being inclusive in that manner, but the behaviors are slowly kind of changing, and you can see people's thoughts changing, and you can see their actions changing. So I think it's just being, you know, again, talking about that patience and that struggle for a democratic culture. I hope that's a good illustration to the audience of some ways that we've been kind of struggling, just on some small practical ways to kind of shift and change our own actions, to be able to shift and change our thinking and our overall behavior. But it's an ongoing struggle. I mean, all these things against this tokenism that you're talking about, it shows up in many forms. It's not just in the form of race. It's not just in the form of gender. It shows up, you know, in age. It shows up in the region. It shows up in urban and rural. You know, it manifests itself in a lot of different ways, and we kind of have to be constantly vigilant about it, in terms of both addressing it and recognizing it. Sometimes recognizing is itself a challenge, and being conscious of things that don't necessarily fit within our kind of normative purview of how we behave and how we see the world and the cultures that we fit in, so that we can actually be inclusive and see beyond just our own narrow and very limited and confined lenses.
I think social justice movements have long been laboratories for routing out and exposing injustice and inequalities in all formats. And as you were really quite eloquently pointing out, it happens internal to the movement as well as external within the society to which the movement belongs. You know, I received a kind of poignant message from someone the other day. I'm a white heterosexual woman, and this was also a white, I don't know their sexuality of this person, but she was just saying, I've been making sandwiches for so long. I'm so tired of just supporting the movements, and I'm really frustrated at always having to be in the support role, but I also understand that there's so many other injustices swirling around us in this work. What should I do with this feeling of the mutual injustices that are being faced? How do I both support my, I think she was referring to a racial inequality. So how do I support, you know, Black women speaking and taking the stage, or Native women speaking and getting the microphone, and deal with this feeling that I'm having? And really what's coming up as a response in this conversation is that we have so much to learn from one another, mm-hmm. that the feelings mm-hmm. are so real, the experiences are real, and we can always do that breakdown of, like, I've suffered and been oppressed more than thou. And it goes all sorts of ways and directions we hardly imagine when we're looking at it at first glance, but it's a very deep conversation. But the take home for me is always, what can I learn? What can I learn? What can I learn from the stories that people are bringing to the table? We are, unfortunately, getting into this really, as you said, deep and lengthy conversation right at the end of the show. This always happens to us. But that's what happens when people start dialogues. And so, as you said, and encourage the listeners and also the people involved in Ungovernable to do, is to open these conversations again and again so we do have the time to work our way through it. I'm just going to remind the listeners that this is Kali Akuno, who is a member of Cooperative Jackson. He's also the co-instigator of Ungovernable, which we've been talking about during this show. He's also a participant. I think that's one of the wonderful qualities that you bring to this work, Kali, is that you always acknowledge and live from your experience inside the changes that we're trying to be in the world. So I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for that, and then pass the microphone back to you for last comments and words and reflections as we head into the last 5 minutes of the show.
Well, the thing that I would touch most upon, we have an opportunity right now, I think, to really transform this society in a profound way. And I really just want to encourage everyone to seize it. And, you know, we start with the small and the practical and move our way up. I don't like the up narrative, but I can't think of a better way to kind of describe it so that we reach more people. You know, but we need to have some deep conversations, you know, with our neighbors, within our communities, with people who we don't know, I think most importantly, and with people who we do. Because there's sometimes a familiarity also breeds a certain type of ignorance, because there's so many things that actually happen in our communities and things that people desire and know that they don't share because social custom does not allow you to. So we shouldn't also cut short conversations with those who we think we know, and how much more can we know them, and encourage people to share so that we can all become, you know, richer and fuller. You know, I think that there is a lot to be concerned about. There is a tremendous amount of urgency to the period. And we should act with urgency. We should act with care in the moment. But I have a deep belief that we can and will rise to the occasion, I think, to meet the challenges of our age. And Trump is just kind of one thing that I think has kind of pulled the covers off of a lot of the lies and the fictitions that have been built up in this society. And for that, I think we need to resist it becoming more painful than it should be. But I think it helps us to also have a deeper conversation about how the society is run and who is it benefited and why is it structured and set up that way, so we can have a serious conversation about what we can do and what we will do to change it.
I agree with you, Kali. Thank you so much. I looked at the numbers and saw that they're calling what happened on Saturday the largest demonstration in U.S. history. And like you, I believe that we can create the largest grassroots movement in human history, in human history. And I'm happy to be a participant in it with you. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to more.
I need you to be loved, 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 loved and revolution. Love, love, love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our incredible guest, Kali Yacuno, for his critical and timely conversation with us. I think that what we discussed today is going to be just the beginning of an ongoing discussion that we're going to be engaged in for the next several years, maybe longer. And I'd also like to thank my incredible co-host, who I am always so thankful to share the airwaves with, Miss Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry Mitchell. I am really appreciating the way that we are deepening into the heart of change and changes of the heart. Just as we always say in our slogan every show, we're really going for it this year in a time when we need it more than ever. So thank you. If you are enjoying the depth that Sherry is bringing to these conversations, I think you should check out her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. We put that link on the Love and Revolution page and on the podcast notes. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and local radio stations can broadcast it. It does our hearts and our souls good to have these words going through our local airwaves. So if you think your local station would carry it, just call them up and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week we heard from Kali Yacuno on being ungovernable. The true measure of democracy is when the power is vested in the people and exercised by them directly or indirectly. Holding power over people is not an attribute of a democratic society. Ungovernable is a movement that refuses to allow the governance of our oppression, the governance of hatred, and the removal of civil and human rights, or any of the other hard-won gains of our collective struggles. So, listeners, we encourage you to look around and to discover if you can find a way to become a participant in true democracy and be ungovernable by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew that your actions determined the outcome of everything? How would you play if your actions determined